Okay, we've got some great mentors on the call today, Guy and Steve and Debbie, so hopefully we'll have an open discussion. First thing, we always like to announce that we're not EPA, but we've been working with the program since it started, so our open discussions are not policy statements or even the viewpoint of EPA, but they do represent some really experienced grantees and the experience of grantees since the beginning of the program. So we'd like to have this open discussion. The advantage we have is we can talk about these issues of how you can make your program better if you've got an ongoing grant or if you're getting ready for a re-up, some things you may want to consider that may give you an edge in terms of getting refunded by EPA. If you've already got a program, it gives you a chance to mentor others or tune up your program. So we'd like to have these open discussions, even though they're not EPA policy. I think sometimes they're useful to get some other opinions and compare it to what you're doing now in terms of your job training. We always like to start off with news from Washington. Glo, did you hear anything from Joe this week?
Yeah, I did. Just a couple of reminders that he wanted me to tell any prospective applicants that are on the call today. He just wanted me to remind you, first of all, if you have not registered yet for grants.gov, then you should probably do that now because that does take some time. And one of the new requirements of the grants this year is that that's the only way they will accept your proposal. So if you have not registered for grants.gov, do it as soon as you can. The other thing he wanted me to let everybody know is that the FAQs for the guidelines is now on EPA's website. I did download it just a little bit ago and have talked to our IT department, so we're going to have that put onto the Brownfields toolbox as well. It'll be right on the homepage, right by the FY15 grant application, and on EPA's website, it is right next to the FY15 RFP announcement that they've got. And the last and final thing that he wanted me to remind everybody is to be sure to report your numbers in acres. And if you have any testimonials from your graduates, he would really love to have those. They are trying to put something together, a marketing piece, so that they can work with more with employers and hopefully help grantees place their graduates in jobs. And that was all he had to say this week.
Good. He had, of course, those two webcasts. One sort of repeated the other, but they were very informative. He went through the RFP, and they had some good hints. I was trying to watch the number of participants in each of those webcasts to get an idea of how many people might be applying for the 17 grants. We're 3.4 million, so at 200,000 a grant, that'd be about 17. Usually, and that doesn't mean they're going to do that this year, but often about half are re-ups for those who have grants that are going to be re-upping, and about half new. That could vary depending on the proposals and the quality of the proposals. But there seem to be about 30 or so people at these webcasts, which is interesting because a lot of people won't be applying, like Glo and I were there, and some regional people were there. So I just got this underlying feeling that the chances are going to be good this year, unless there's some very confident people who don't feel they wanted to see what EPA had to say officially about the RFP. But it sounds like it might be a good time to apply for this grant. Did someone just join?
Yes, Mark Boyd, Monroe State College.
Okay, Mark. Pemrose. As I was saying, it may be a really good time to apply for this grant. Of course, what's going to be important is that you answer all of the questions very precisely, and you have some good answers. And, of course, you certainly don't want to get knocked out in the qualifying criteria. But what we wanted to talk about today was what I consider the most important part of the whole project, and it's really the base for everything else. And if you do this now, it's going to make all the other jobs really simple. There's there are certain parts of this writing this grant that are just filling out tables, and you can anyone can get the data because it's already out there. They can do this. A grant writer could do this fairly easy. But there are parts of this grant that separate the winners from the ones that are not funded, and these are more long-term, and they're the ones that really form the base. And if you can get a solid base, it's going to make your life a whole lot easier for the rest of the grant. And I'm really talking about, I call it community and employer needs assessments, but really it's, if you do this, you're going to do everything. It's a matter of developing relationships. And it really goes to the heart of the two biggest ranking. Of course, we have the qualifying criteria, and then we've got the ranking criteria, and then we've got the other factors, and then we've got the attachments, which are references. And getting your assessment and getting your team together and meeting will really apply itself to all of these things. Within the ranking criteria, the two biggest are community and employer partnerships and community needs. And those are represent 45 points in the ranking criteria. And a lot of that has to do with these partnerships that you're going to form. It's also critical in terms of some of the other ranking criteria like curriculum, leveraging, student support, and sustainability. So what I'm getting at is basically getting your committee together. And at this point, those of you who have had grants in the past or have a grant now are going to have a lot easier job because you've already developed those relationships. For the new grantees who are just applying, this is going to be a little more difficult. And what we're talking about is getting your committee together, and hopefully you've got that together. These are going to be certainly someone from the WIB, Workforce Investment Board, your staff, employers, hopefully someone from the city, and this is going to be a working team. And of course, you always want to document all your meetings, whether you use it as part of the grant or not. It's good to document the meetings, and of course, as you write the grant, which we'll be talking about at a later PLC, you'll want to bring some of these items to bear in your grant process. But the whole idea, and in last week's notes, I suggested one strategy that one of our grantees and one of our PLCs mentioned. Did someone just join?
Hi, yes, this is Nicole Bates from Region 4.
Okay, Nicole. One of the grantees and one of the PLCs said the way we, and they'd been successful on several grants, so they said the way we approached this was we went into that RFP and we just dissected it. And we looked for every question that was asked. And we put these on separate pieces of paper. Of course, you could do this digitally. But we got our team together, and we had our meeting, and we started assigning different aspects of this to each participant. And we got employers involved. We were able to get someone from the city involved. We had our training people there at the meeting. Basically, this composed of our partners, our staff, our potential employers, and someone in the city. And we assigned everyone a little job. Some people had some heavy lifting to do, others it was a little bit easier. And we had frequent meetings of what we had to deliver in this program to make it a good program. And we assigned everyone to do something. And then we set up another meeting date. And everyone came back with this. Now you're going to have a grant writer who's going to have to put all this together, the wordsmith. But the person that's the grant writer can't possibly put this program together, and they shouldn't. They need to only take the words that people provide them and put them in a singular, coherent document that fits all of the requirements of the RFP. But the real lifting for a sustainable program, for any program, and whether you're applying for this grant or not, you need to approach it this way. You need to get your team together. And you need to have frequent meetings. Now, this is bad timing because we're over the holidays, but it's something you're going to have to do, and it might be a good time because people will have some more open time between now and the 24th, and then maybe they'll be able to have another meeting before New Year's and after New Year's. A lot of people are shut down, so it might be a little more difficult. But if you have someone, if, for example, on your team, if one of the things you wanted to get to is the mayor's office. If you get someone that can tie you into what's going on in your communities in terms of any RLF funding, any assessment programs, any area-wide planning grants, any cleanup grants, any Superfund grants, if there's wastewater activity going on, you want to find out who that person is. You're going to need to go to the Office of Economic Development at least and try to find out if who in the city is doing this. And by getting someone at this meeting, you're going to be able to take care of a whole lot of the other issues that come in later. For example, we're expecting that the people who are on your committees will be able to provide you the references that you're going to need in your attachments. You're going to have to provide two previous employers, two neighborhood community groups, two employers that hopefully will be considering your grantees. So if these people are on your planning committee, it's going to be easy to provide these references. And not only that, you have to give names and phone numbers. When these people are called, they're going to say, yes, I'm very familiar with the program. I'm their planning committee. It's going to put your proposal way ahead of everyone else. So, again, you want to have a meeting. And if you've got an established program, the grant that you received from the last cycle that you were in, it may be more competitive this time. And we've had many grantees who have been funded, but then when they ran into this, as we go on, these proposals are becoming more sophisticated. What you got away with or were funded and was a really good proposal 3 years ago or 2 years ago may not do it today. You've got the advantage, though, is you've got your people together and you can call your meetings. Ideally, you're going to have some public meetings. You're certainly going to have someone in the community on your committee that you're going to be meeting with. So by forming this committee, you're going to make your life so much easier when at the last moment you're going to have to get your references together for your attachment section. You're going to have the names, the phone numbers, you've got reference letters, and you've got your partners. So it's a matter of building that team. And again, as we said, you're certainly going to want someone, if you can get them from the Workforce Investment Board, someone from the academic institution or a trainer. It may not be an academic institution, maybe a trainer. You're going to want someone who may be able to get you into a public meeting like a city council meeting. And if you are working with Office of Economic Development and you're in the mayor's office, ask them if you could make an announcement at the next city council meeting that you're planning on developing a workforce development, environmental workforce development training program, and that you'd like to make that announcement, which you will document and put into your proposal. The non-environmental training, of course, which will give you your leverage, will come from Workforce Investment Board, but there may be Health and Human Services or some other organizations in your communities. And, of course, your employers may be able to provide you with stipends. If you're in an urban area and you have organized labor unions, you may try to get someone to one of your meetings from and this would be usually the manager of the union, have them come to your meeting. If you can get some site owners or contractors, previous people who would tend to hire your graduates. You've had some experience with this. How have you approached this when you start reaching out to the community? Okay, Guy? Oh, okay. I'm looking for Guy Zazak. Guy? Okay. He's not there. Is there anyone else there that has reached out to the community and gotten their programs together?
A lot of times it's like the local business or industry that'll take the leap, and sometimes it'll be more of the citizen community groups that will show the focus. And what surprises me all the time is how much and back in the day, the college or university would really listen when it was somebody from outside the four walls of the college more than they would maybe their own faculty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was really important that you get someone that's maybe not a traditional player in these grants to come to your meeting.
Exactly.
It
doesn't have to be somebody who's on the board of directors or whatever, but there's kind of an old saying, the further away you come, the more of an expert you are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So somebody who's either a Fortune 500 company or somebody who's active in the neighborhood or a community organization, it's hard to put your finger on, but sometimes the right person with the right message at the right time will pull all of these other people together. And then when you put it into the grant application, you really do have almost a unified force behind you to do this. And I hate to say it, but sometimes if you do it over a 4, 5, or 10-year period, some of those partners that you had either just go away or they get stale or there's actually bickering.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that sometimes I know one particular grantee that I visited got some local employers together, and those employers, while they were competitors, became friends. And then started doing some heavy lifting in terms of, I was getting notices from the employers about meetings, not from the key staff that I would expect. And they were very effective in getting the employer community to buy into this program. And of course, why shouldn't they? They were hiring graduates. And so it made their grant application very simple because their employers were their partners. They were hiring their graduates. Oh, you need reference letters. I'm on board. You know, I'm helping you with this. So they're buying in. They're hiring the graduates. They've had some good experience with graduates. And it becomes kind of a steamroller. But as Guy said, you've got to be careful that it could also become stale. So you have to continually seek out some new partners.
Go ahead. Well, this actually happened this morning at 8 o'clock. At one time, classes were always held at the institution and training happened, and that was the old model. And then for a good 10-15 year period or longer, you would go to a specific company and do specific training for their employees, and that's the model they liked because they didn't have to worry about travel or anything. This morning, we had three different companies. Well, two other companies were invited by a host company to do training at their site. If you had told a grant, a funding source, or a college or university, okay, that you would be running what was considered open enrollment classes at somebody's plant or factory or manufacturing site, they would kind of laugh at you. But that seems to be more of the norm lately.
Mm-hmm. And it's really the way this is shifting. And the more you can get outsiders into your grant proposal and into your program, it's going to speak to everything that EPA is looking for in terms of collaboration with local remediation activities, with partnership building. And of course, everyone is so focused on employment and employer involvement. And, you know, you don't have to get, when they say get a employer to commit to hiring your employees, you say, well, no employer is going to say, I'm going to hire 5-year graduates. You might get lucky, they will, if they're very large. But a slight rephrase of that is, I'll look at your graduates. And most employers would say, I'll be happy to look at your graduates. I'll be happy to attend your employer night. I'll be happy to give you a presentation about what we do, or I'll be happy to even teach a class. And so when we talk about these employer commitments, I think you could phrase that a different way, committed to look at your graduates. And that really is holds almost as much weight as I will hire, because no one really knows their staffing needs, nor do they necessarily know the quality of your graduates. So with that slight switch, you can bring them over onto your side to participate in your program. And of course, it makes it a lot easier when you're you're developing your program plan of not necessarily committal, but look at. And it's also important when you start talking to other partners in terms of somewhat conditional. If you get this grant, this is what we can help you with. And it's really important to make sure you get those workforce investment boards, because when they're in it, you start talking about answering all your questions regarding leveraging, all of your questions about student support, many of your questions sometimes on recruitment and placement, which we talk about later, because some of these WIBs are more active and proactive in terms of providing you with services. Some will screen all of your applicants and see who qualifies and may give them instructional materials or boots or safety materials. They may give them health services. They may provide ancillary services. They may also provide all your life skills training. So that's why it's important to find out who your workforce investment board is, or if they're not supplying these services, who is. When you start having these meetings, as I said earlier, some people are going to be doing heavy lifting, and some people may just be participants and listeners, and that's okay. The fact is that they all need to know what you're doing, and when you have a meeting, you might have a fairly large meeting, and you may ask for volunteers who could provide us with this, who could help us with this. Some people will perhaps raise their hand or come to the front and say, I'm really into this, and I really want to do it. It may surprise you who those people are going to be. And then some may, their workload is a little too heavy. They're for you. They're going to support your program, but they don't really have the time or energy or maybe the connections to participate in your program in a big way. But they need to be at the meeting, and they need to know that if someone were to call them, they would know all about your program. You know, as part of these assessments too, some of our grantees, I think in the last cycle, about three of them said, we always ask them, what's your takeaway in terms of making your placement and your program successful? And they said, almost invariably, you got to know your market. You got to know your market. And this, again, if you do this now in this assessment period, it's going to make your life a whole lot easier. If you're trying to do asbestos and lead training in a young community, you're going to be knocking your head against the wall because there isn't lead and asbestos in your community. But if you're in Boston, lead and asbestos may be where you're going. Recycling is the same way, or medical. If you have underground storage tanks, and you may be in a rural area where there's lots of underground storage tanks, or you may have none of these things, but one of the interesting things about this year is pest management and wastewater are certainly big candidates as far as training and placement. In the past, pest management did not be included. Well, it could be, you might say, well, I live in a new community, so we don't have lead and asbestos issues. We do recycling, but we do have wastewater plants, and we don't have any Superfunds. We do have medical issues. We may have medical waste, but everyone has pest management, and many have wastewater. So you've got to assess in your community who your employers are likely to be. And if you choose the wrong ones early, you're going to mess up on everything else. You're going to mess up on your target group. You're going to mess up on your curriculum. And you're going to mess up on your placement. So you're going to be struggling through the entire grant. So the question is, how do you do that assessment? And has anyone got any ideas of what really works for them in terms of trying to figure out what is the buzz pollutant, or what is the pollutant that's big in their area? What does anyone have any feeling of what's a good approach for that? Okay. Well, go ahead.
Mike, yes. This is Steve Schaefer. When we started our grant a couple years ago, it was very much employer-driven and by asbestos contractors. A couple large asbestos abatement contractors. The problem is that once the really heavy demand went away and some of the bit larger projects went away, the labor demand is not there like it was, and it has concerned us about placing these individuals that graduate from our training programs in a stop and start career. For instance, where maybe they get on the job for a few months and then all of a sudden there's no work for that particular contractor, and then we're having to place them with another contractor, and there's a lot of gaps in their employment. And so what we are really trying to do now is to discover those other areas of demand, of labor demand, that fit with the EPA, within the EPA guidelines in terms of what industries fit the mold.
Right.
And we had very strong employer support at the beginning of this, and they're still well-meaning, but if they don't have the work, they don't have the work.
Right. I'm kind of intrigued by the pest management that was added this year. It's never been done before, but there's lots of jobs, and I wouldn't speak for EPA or pretend to that, but if it turns out that you come up blank on all these others, it's something you may want to look at. The wastewater is another interesting one. We keep hearing about all the people that are retiring in wastewater, and that's true. All the people that went in the 70s in wastewater are retiring, but there's a counter to that, in that over the years, no one has supported wastewater training except for on-the-job training and the private firms. And so because EPA used to support wastewater training in a big way, they stopped in the 80s or 90s, in the 1990s. So the private sector took over and the municipalities took over, and I wouldn't say they're patronage jobs, but they're jobs that once you get in, they train you once you're on the job. There have been some grantees who are, of course, you have to get the certifications to be a full-fledged wastewater operator, you have to be on the job, and it's difficult to at certain levels, but you need to get in the door. Some grantees have been fairly successful in convincing the municipalities that we can give you pre-trained people with good background and pre-screening if you'll consider hiring them. Once they get into your organization, you could take it from there to move them up the ladder. Now, that's a great job because it's a municipal job that'll last forever. What happened was they started in the 70s and they're just now retiring, and there's going to be a whole new crop. Traditionally, some of these people who are coming out of school will then apply for the job and they'll get it, and then they'll get their certifications. But we've seen in Alaska it seems to work, where they're creating jobs in wastewater. These are small plants in towns that is not only wastewater but municipal waste sites, dumps and those types of things. They're creating jobs in these smaller communities. There have been some larger communities who have also been successful in getting to know the municipal operators. And if you can get them on your board or get them at least input, those are jobs that are long-term and continuous.
This is Guy. May I jump in here just for a second?
Yeah, Guy. Mm-hmm.
I happen to know a few of those people in upstate New York. And in the past, when you had that large hiring in the 1970s and 80s, everybody got hired, they all went through the training, and pretty much everybody passed. What's happening lately, though, is it's the local water boards, the local regional water, whatever, okay, they're doing the training, and sometimes they have a pass rate that is equal or less than 50%. You were exactly right when you said typically these people are hired, but they're hired for a period of time under the understanding that they will actually pass all their tests and actually become licensed. So where you said they could go through and you do a program that actually preps them for the testing, et cetera, et cetera. They're finding it very difficult because how do you get so many years in, yet you have to be the person who's licensed to run the operation, yet you put the person in and they may or may not what pass the test at the end. It's a hard nut to crack, okay? But everybody, at least across New York State, is sort of fighting the same thing.
Yeah. And the question you have to ask yourself is, do you hire a college graduate that has been tested in terms of academics and would be capable of going through the certification tests, or do you look for some of your best students in your program and try to make a deal with the municipality in terms of broadening their demographics and the people that they're hiring? And you're right, that's a tough call.
And I can't tell you that it's, and I really shouldn't tell you the specific, let's say, water district, but what seems to be successful for them is where you have more of a blend. You have some people who are older female head of household in their 50s, and they're hired on, and they work fantastic in the lab, or they're fantastic operators. And some of the kids that come in are from college, and they work really good on some of the road crews. And some of the other individuals who may or may not have a college education, they understand the effluent and the pipes and can change pumps, and they become like the full operators. There's no seems to be rhyme or reason of who you're going to hire, who's going to be successful and stay in that job. And it's no exaggeration, exactly what you said. You can have that job for 35, 40 years if you want it, if you start early enough.
Mm-hmm.
Once
you
they
think
put you in there, you stay there.
Are there positions, say you're not up to being certified, do you feel there are positions that our graduates might be able to get into? They may never be certified, but maybe we can get them in the door because of our training. Do you see that as a possibility? These would be larger plants, not the small ones.
Yeah, but think about it. All right, maybe I'm telling things that people already know, but a person who's in a wastewater treatment plant may never, ever, ever just drive his truck down the street and visit the guys that are the water treatment. Those are two totally separate departments, and it's two different types of like certification you take. You could run them through a program which says they passed everything in my program and they're ready for whatever, but those people may or may not actually take the test that requires them to be the operator. They could be there's water departments where maybe one-third of everybody who works is a meter reader. In other places, the maintenance on the pipes, in Niagara Falls, we have a water board, okay? With the freeze-thaw we have here all the time, probably 50% of the crews are out digging up streets to keep the water flowing and to do, let's say, hydrant maintenance. But when you get back to the plant itself, the plant that's making your water, that's where you have to have, the licensed individual, that's answerable to the New York State Health Department, who actually signs off and says, I'm running the plant. So to answer your question, there's probably 3 to 4 employees in some water treatment plants that aren't necessarily certified, for every one person who's the actual guy in charge, or the operator.
Mm-hmm. So there is a chance some of these municipalities may work with you in terms of diversifying their workforce and giving people a chance from the community to get jobs, not guaranteeing that they're going to be running the plant someday.
You're absolutely right. And the nice thing about it is instead of just hiring somebody's brother-in-law, and that's what you were sort of alluding to,
right.
You do have a person who has the ability after 5 years of experience or whatever to move up and maybe on Saturdays or week weekends or holidays or whatever, this person could take the test and he could be your alternate operator. Because you really do have to have like 24/7 coverage on some of these operations.
Right. He might be an assistant or an adjunct, someone who could step in when needed. So these are the pest management and wastewater are just, they're not construction type jobs. They're more ongoing jobs. And it's something that some of you may want to look into. And of course, the first thing you're going to have to do is you're going to have to get a hold of people who are the primary employers in your community to see if they think it's a good idea. And if they do, get them on your committee as fast as you can. And never push them into making commitments, but only commitment maybe if they like your graduates, they visit your program, and they like what they see, that they might consider some of your graduates as employees. So. Well, we keep this to 30 minutes. So, Steve, I appreciate your comments, and I will share them with everyone. And y'all have a good Christmas. We're going to take a break until the 7th. So 7th of January will be our next PLC. We're going to talk some more about this, but then also get into this curriculum and budget resources and program capability when we start talking again about improving our program or how many we may want to reorient the program we've got to make it more sustainable. So, well, listen, thanks, everybody, and you all have a good holiday, and we'll talk to you next year.
Okay. Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.